This is Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from our newsroom this week. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. This week, we learned that the Natural Bridge Zoo reopened after getting shut down by the state game agency for multiple violations regarding treatment and care of the animals. Jesse Nadler has the details about the zoo's reinstatement, and we also mixed it up with roller derby in Charlottesville. We'll get to those stories a little later, but first, this week, we kicked off our occasional series airing in June on the trends in pollution and the efforts to fight it in Virginia to make our air, our land, and our water cleaner. And we started with a focus on water and agriculture, which is one of the leading causes of pollution in Virginia's waterways. WMRA's Carol Lofton filed this report.
On Bobby Whitescarver's farm in Swope, cattle graze contentedly on lush pastures beside lazy streams. The whole atmosphere is almost poetic, but it didn't used to be that way.
Before we put these fences up, the cattle had access to all the water. You couldn't drive from one end of the farm to the other one because of the muck.
The muck is a combination of mud stirred up from the hooves of cows that weigh a ton or more and their feces. Whitescarver says when stream banks aren't protected by fences and vegetation, even a light rain can carry the muck from the pastures into nearby streams. Whitescarver worked as a field conservationist for the USDA for 31 years before retiring to focus on writing, farming, and activism. While at the USDA, he helped farmers install watering and fencing systems on almost 500 miles of stream bank. As we walk through his fields, he points to the movable electric fences that line the stream beside one pasture. They are part of a system to block his livestock from the streams. That system also includes 35-foot riparian buffers of native vegetation and trees. The result of livestock runoff is contamination of tributaries by fecal coliform, antibiotics, and growth hormones. These tributaries feed into rivers such as the Shenandoah, Potomac, and James, which provide central and western Virginia residents with drinking water, recreation, and fishing opportunities. They are also dirty enough that the Virginia Department of Health has issued fish consumption advisories for all three rivers. According to Virginia's Department of Environmental Quality, the agricultural pollutants in our waterways fall into three main categories: bacteria from livestock, excess nutrients from fertilizer, and sediment from runoff. The problem is linked to rain. When rain falls on well-vegetated land, the vegetation actually helps the ground absorb the water by preventing the water from rolling downhill to the nearest stream, pond, or puddle. Back at his farm, Whitescarver points to a stream beside one of his pastures.
My actions on this farm affect that water. And what we do on our land greatly affects the quality of the water. Because the soil out here, this open space, is the regulator of the water cycle. When rain falls on good, well-managed land like this, it goes through the soil, which is a big carbon filter, recharges the groundwater, and gets into the stream. So it's our filter. If you've got a feedlot or it's bare soil, pesticides, fertilizer runoff, there's a whole litany of pollutants. When rainwater hits that and it runs off, it gets in that water and it pollutes it for everybody else. So what I do here affects that person, next person, next person downstream.
In a healthy ecosystem, a stream can manage small amounts of excess waste. In fact, for a long time, the motto with conservationists was, "Dilution is the solution." But even a healthy stream struggles to dilute and process the huge influx of waste that accompanies rain near unprotected agricultural sites. Cattle in this particular pasture are watered from a gravity-fed watering trough that pulls clean water from the stream into the trough. Whitescarver said the change has almost eliminated scours, foot rot, and other common cattle diseases. The fences have also almost halved fecal coliform in the stream water passing through his farm.
90% of all the streams are small. So if we can protect these small streams, get them protected, that's where you start cleaning up a watershed.
Replanting the stream banks with native vegetation like Whitescarver has is considered a best management practice. These are practices that Gary Flory, of the Department of Environmental Quality, helps farmers implement to reduce the amount of pollution coming from their farms. Flory says these practices are making a huge difference.
We'll work with a farmer to put together a plan that they develop, and they give us a time frame for what can you reasonably do to address these areas of potential discharge on your farm, and how long is it going to take you to do it.
Flory says the program is generally well received by farmers because his team tries to work with the farmers to design a system that works well for a particular farm and budget. The reduction in agricultural pollution is not only making livestock healthier, White Scarver says, but is cleaning up drinking and recreational water for everyone, even those outside of agricultural areas.
You know, farms that are well managed, meaning they're building soil, health, there's no livestock in the streams, they've got buffers, you know, vegetative buffers, native trees along the banks. Those farms are producing clean water, they're sequestering carbon, they're creating wildlife habitat, pollinator corridors. You know, that's a benefit to you.
For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
The embattled Natural Bridge Zoo, which was shut down by the State Game Commission back in March, is once again open for business as of last weekend. WMRA's Jesse Nadler has the story.
It's been a long 3 months for Carl and Debbie Mogensen, owners of the Natural Bridge Zoo. In March, the Virginia Department of Game and Inland Fisheries suspended the zoo's license to exhibit wild animals. The state agency used a USDA inspection report from January to conclude that, quote, many of the animals are confined under unsanitary and inhumane conditions. Since the zoo, which is not accredited by any zoological organization, was shut down, the Mogensens have been trying to come into compliance with the Animal Welfare Act. Among the changes, spending $35,000 on the creation of a new veterinary care program and getting rid of a controversial exhibit that allowed patrons to pose for photographs while holding baby tiger cubs. But despite the zoo's changes, it was unclear when or even if the USDA would come back for a follow-up inspection. The delay has cost the zoo, which attracts 70,000 visitors each year, $250,000 in lost business since March. Carl Mogensen has had to sell off numerous monkeys, camels, and other exotic animals to cover costs. But the USDA finally did come back on May 19th for a second inspection. Asha, the zoo's sole elephant, was found to have a minor foot injury that is being tended to. Rabbits were identified as being confined in cages outside optimum temperature ranges. All rabbits were given away by the time inspectors came back the following day, according to Carl. Other than that, the second inspection verified that the zoo had corrected a majority of the violations against it. In its May 27th letter to Carl Mogensen, the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries stated that it is, quote, satisfied that the Natural Bridge Zoo is substantially compliant with the animal welfare violations, unquote, and its wildlife exhibitor's permit was reinstated the same day. The zoo's opening day was May 30th. The USDA will return for a routine unannounced follow-up inspection in roughly 6 months. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
For some, the words roller derby bring to mind the 2009 movie Whippet, starring Ellen Page. Some other folks maybe more familiar with the sport might think of women in dramatic makeup and crazy clothing crashing into each other on a flat racetrack. But for the women of Charlottesville's Derby Dames, the words roller derby are much more synonymous with strength, confidence, competition, fun, and above all, camaraderie. WMRA's Kara Lofton reports.
All right, we're going to get started.
It was Saturday afternoon at the Main Street Arena in Charlottesville, and the Belmont Bruisers were lining up against the Southern Delaware Roller Girls. The teams are made up of women of all shapes and sizes in their late teens to mid-40s. Both teams sported jerseys with the women's derby names printed on the back, such as Bella Muerta, Bad Squish, and Sparkills. The names allow the women to be whoever they want to be. It's an opportunity to reinvent oneself for a while into a persona that may exist only on the track. Derby is a kind of athletic theater that also includes costumes of outlandish clothing and heavy makeup. The ability to play dress-up and be tough at the same time is one of the things that attracted Sparkills, also known as Laura Fisher, to the sport. Fisher is one of the founding members of the Dames. The appealing thing for her now about Derby is that the sport attracts an incredibly diverse cross-section of people who all find something unique and exciting in it for them.
People come to it for different reasons. There are people that are here because of the quirky social, and there are people who have never, ever done anything team-oriented or athletic. Like, they, you know, it's not their thing, and they are loving it. I mean, there are people who've done sports all their life. So I don't know. I don't know that you can say that there's one thing that draws, but there is that feeling of community.
The theatrical aspect is less important these days as the dames move away from a purely performance-based endeavor to a realm of competitive athletics, Fisher said.
She does make it on her initial pass. So her teammates are working together to see what they can do to help her score some points while the other dammers in the box.
A roller derby match is called a bout. The total play time of a bout is 60 minutes, which is broken into 30-minute halves called periods. A period is broken up into an indefinite number of jams, which are where the real action happens.
A jam is sometimes compared to an inning in baseball because of how the game is divided. Both teams will send out five players from their own team, four defensive, one is offensive, and the jam can run up to 2 minutes, but it can be as short as 30 seconds.
That was Sharon Lawler. She is a member of the Belmont Bruisers, the Derby Dames B team, and followed up with me a few days after Saturday's match. The Derby Dames A team is called the All-Stars and is currently ranked 42nd in the world. Lawler explained that points are scored when the offensive player, called the jammer, breaks through the pack of defensive players, called blockers, on the other team, and completes a lap to end up behind the opposition's defense again. It can be a rough-and-tumble process. Both Lawler and Fisher, though, said one of the things they love about derby is that it's a contact sport. Lawler said getting hit is actually a huge confidence booster for a lot of the women.
Getting hit makes you learn a little bit about yourself and how you respond to situations around you.
Fisher agrees.
I love the getting hit. Like, not that I love to get hit, but I just, like, there's something about, so women are not, I mean, there are lots of strong women, but it's not something that is that you can embrace and be like, I'm this tough girl, right?
A little taboo.
Yeah, and there's something about it that feels really, that's just really fun.
For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
I think roller derby is a hopeful thing.
He earned enough money from selling plants that he paid off the mortgage on his house.
People always want to know, is that a lie or is that the truth?
I completely disassembled this Triumph TR6.
I wish I could have been a professional woman soccer player.
I'm Martha Woodruff, and this is The Spark, an exploration of interesting people doing interesting things. Patrick Mayerchek is a retired VMI faculty member, which makes him around my age. And yes, he's another boomer with fond memories of the 60s, particularly of the band he and four of his University of Kentucky buddies had from 1964 through much of 1968. The Shoguns, Patrick says, played a lot of old-style rock and roll songs, some of which he wrote.
From about 65 through 67, we were the house band at the Avenue Nightclub in Bellevue, Kentucky. That was an old mafia hangout, because in the 50s, Newport, Kentucky and Campbell County were controlled by some gentlemen who came down from Cleveland. My buddy I grew up with, Dad was a pit boss and Mom was the nightclub singer. The Avenue Nightclub had a secret room in it. It was owned by two guys, Duke and Elmer, who show up in the lyrics of one of our songs.
Well, Duke poured the drinks and Phil brought the groupies. Elmer counted out the cash.
So we played there for about 3 years. We had standing room only. Then our unofficial bodyguard, a fellow named George Chook, who is departed now, and I'm not speaking ill of him, he was a tough guy in Bellevue who spent many years as a guest of the Department of Corrections down in Frankfort, but the police would not mess with George, and we had no trouble. But one night, there came a big scuffle, glass shattered everywhere, and so that emptied the club. We had an offer, and we went over then to the Four Seasons Marina, which was a floating club over on Kellogg Avenue in Cincinnati, a little bit more upscale. We played there for another year or so. We were playing in greater Cincinnati, and somebody who was connected with, I'm going to say it was Bang Records, but I don't know that that is, if there's some aficionados out there, I can't swear to it. But you had a group out there, the Ohio Express, I think from Cleveland. They had a song, Yummy, 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 I Got Love in My Tummy.
Yes.
Yummy, 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 I got love in my tummy, and I feel like I'm loving you.
Our lead singer, Dan, mentioned, I think, that he had met somebody or that it had a conversation, and the point was the Ohio Express was disintegrating or had disintegrated. They were looking for a band to step in with their original singer and carry on. I just remember myself or one of my buddies making the comment, I'm not going to play that kind of music. So, you know, that...
Not for you. You got standards.
Yeah, and even if somebody had say, hey, here's a contract, I don't think we'd have done it.
Yeah.
In my time, you know, I have seen plenty. In my time, you know, I have no many.
We released a song, which is on the new CD. You'll see a song there called In My Time. What we really have there is the demo track. It came out as a record with violins. I got five people from the Lexington Symphony Orchestra. That was put out on what was called the Schwarr record label, and that's because our buddy was Big Jim Schwarr, a local disc jockey in northern Kentucky. And so he and his brother, who was a doctor, put it out. Phil would come over and play drums at the Avenue nightclub with us. Big Jim was a good friend, and so that was Schwarr Records. Then in 1968, we had a recording. This would have been, I'll just say, February or March. I get a call from the bass player, Fred DeShawn, and he says, listen to this. And then he said, here it is, WUBE, the pick hit of the week, the Shoguns. Let's see, what's the name of the song? Here it is, it's the Shoguns, the look in my eyes. The look in her eyes. Let's get it right.
Look in her eyes, it's all very plain. She doesn't need you, you're just one of her games. The dreams of the night are gone with the sun. You can't penetrate to the look in her eyes.
That was a pop song. One of the guys had taken it over to the station, and they put it right on. When we tried to get In My Time on the radio, and I think they're not in business anymore, so I'll mention it. WSAI, the other big rocker in greater Cincinnati, said, no problem. $100 will get you 7 plays, one a week.
Da-da-da-da,
you know.
The look in her eyes, it's wild and it's free. The laugh that she laughs, ain't so funny to me. The touch of a hand is so cold, no surprise. And I'm turned into stone by the look in her eyes.
Eventually, after college graduation, life intervened, as life tends to do. The Shoguns disbanded, only to come together again 40 years later and record a CD. And the Shoguns came together again, Patrick Mayerchuk says, at just the right time.
Living in dreams ain't hard as it seems. Making the present the past. Living delusion, avoiding confusion. We know that dreams never last. High on a mountain, words flow from a fountain. Searching for meaning and rhyme. Building new bridges across blue ridges. Could be it's just the right time.
Over those years, I thought we almost made it. If I'd have stuck around, we had a pick hit. Who knows, you know. And so I said, I'd just like to get the Shoguns together again. So here it is, 2010. And I had been in constant contact with Fred DeShawn, the bass player, and a couple of the other guys. I mean, we were in contact, but Fred and I have been just, we were roommates and all of that sort of thing. And so I said, well, why don't we get together? And I said, well, yeah, I guess we could try. And I'm the only one, Martha, who has played music over the years. I was out for a while, but in the 1980s, I got back and met some friends in Lexington. We had a group called House Mountain for almost 25 years. But the other guys hadn't played, so I dug out a song list from the club. I just said, hey, check this out. So somewhere there in 2010, I came over. Dan Herzog, the lead singer who lives in Florida, came up. And it turned out we could play. It wasn't quite as smooth as it was, but for guys who hadn't played in 40 years, it was really, pretty doggone good.
Did you still have that synergy?
Yes.
Or you still have that? Oh, yeah.
We still have that. And that's just something you can't make that happen. It's just good fortune, I would say.
You'll find links and pictures of the Shoguns then and now on the Spark page at WMRA.org.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our coverage possible, comes from Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus, Janet Trentner, Rory and Jamie Kutaya, Joy Loving, Jim and Pam Huggins, and an anonymous donor. And you too can contribute to in-depth coverage of issues, events, and people in our community. Find out more about the News and Information Fund at WMRA.org. You'll find stories from the WMRA newsroom and more information at our website, WMRA.org. Be sure to like us on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio for a heads up on our coverage. And you can follow me on Twitter at WMRA Bob. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I'll see you in the morning.